Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the time being. We're going to have with us tonight Tom Plocko. And Tom, of course, is a gentleman that I've talked to on a number of occasions before. And he has, of course, been monitoring the committee investigations being held at the present time to determine what happened at 911. Now, of course, we know that the initial report was released. And, of course, even much of the information that had been given under oath there was classified. In other words, even though the information was put out, the government classified it so it couldn't be released in the report. Page after page is blacked out. There are 28 pages or 26 or 28 pages blacked out of information on Saudi Arabia. Now, if Saudi Arabia was not involved in funding Al-Qaeda and in funding what happened on 9/11, why block it out? And if they were involved, don't you think the American people should know? But you see, everything is, well, we have nothing to hide, but we're going to hide it anyway. Or I think there's a great deal to hide because, you see, 9/11 was a defining moment. 9/11 was a watershed event. Since 9/11, the American people are increasingly coming under surveillance. Would we have accepted the USA Patriot Act 1 and 2, which is coming down the line, and the Office of Homeland Security, and going through the check stiles there when we check into the airport and we have to take off our shoes, even though the whole story of John Reed, the mad bomber, was a sham, because, of course, he had C4 in his shoes, and you can't light it with a fuse, and, of course, he'll spend the rest of his life in jail because he was set up as a patsy by somebody who told him, oh, we're going to really fix those terrible infidels, you know, you just light this fuse. And of course, anybody who knows anything about C4 knows you have to have blasting caps. But because of that now, of course, the American people dutifully take off their shoes. And we go through the turnstiles and we acknowledge the fact government has a right to watch every single one of us because of the wicked Osama bin Laden, who used to work for the CIA, and because of the 15 of the 19 terrorists who flew into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon that day came from Saudi Arabia. But we can't let the American people know what was in that report because we're afraid Osama bin Laden and Muhammad Atta will find out. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the greatest put-on of all time. You've got to understand reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. Well, with us is Tom Plocko. Tom, are you there?
Yes, we are.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you tell us, are you still monitoring what's happening back there and at those meetings?
Well, I'll tell you, the meetings have pretty much quieted down. After we knew on the 22nd and 23rd there was going to be a lot of fireworks, and there was. I really say that the genesis, the beginning of this whole latest 9/11 flap, where it's really come back to the fore. Had a lot of its beginnings in that 22nd and 23rd series of meetings and testimonies that were given before the 9/11 Commission, because they involved the military generals. And
I'm sorry, was this the 22nd and 23rd of this
May?
Of May. Okay.
May.
All right.
And then those testimonies were very. We also had Norman Mineta, and you had. The Secretary of Transportation, and you had the other woman who was Jane. I can't think of her last name now, but the administrator of the FAA, and their testimonies. The timelines were botched up; they didn't add up at all. And then, of course, there were a lot of reporters there. A number of us were sitting in the back. I would say probably 30 or 40 at times, but at least 25 or so. And there were people writing stories, and of course, a lot of the information we acquired outside the hearing room, when we got a chance to talk to generals face to face and ask them tough questions, and talk to FAA administrators, and there are still a couple stories that haven't even been reported. I haven't seen them anywhere yet that I have in my notebook, that I'm going to start sticking in a couple things that I've already added to my agenda for coming stories.
Well, of course, those are up on your website.
What's up right now is a brand new story that was posted yesterday, and it's getting tremendous hits. This is at TomFlocco.com. Now, for those of your listeners, it's FLOCCO, F like in Frank, TomFlocco, FLOCCO.com. And the story is titled Former Congressional Nominee, and it happens to be my researcher, Michael Thomas of Phoenix, Arizona. He was threatened by a United States Marshal. And this happened a couple months ago, and we started writing the story, and we've been adding to it and adding to it, and we've just been, trying to decide when to release the story, and we decided to release it, right during this particular time when there was a lot going on with the questioning, like you had said, the 28 pages that are redacted and missing, and then also the weapon, the issue of the uranium, and the 16 words in the inauguration speech, and those are closing a lot of flap right now.
That 16 words is sort of a non-issue. I mean, it really detracts us from the really important thing is, were there weapons of mass destruction? Were we threatened by the weapons of mass destruction that, of course, we were told we knew were there, and, gallons and millions of gallons or whatever it was, this, that, and the other thing. All these weapons of mass destruction that threatened America, most a ridiculous thing. Fidel Castro has biochemical and chemical labs, biological and chemical labs in Cuba that really do threaten us, and yet we go halfway around the world, and of course when we get there we can't find them. Well, Tom, before you go on, tell us of what those generals told you. What was the testimony? Because the question is, why were there no planes in the air on the morning of September 11th? We were on maximum alert. We knew there was a planned attack. It was going to come, and maybe they can say, well, we didn't know it was on the 11th of September, but obviously some people knew, because people from the Defense Department canceled their flights for that day. We know that Mayor Willie Brown was notified the previous evening, because I personally verified that with his press secretary. So, we know that they knew an attack was coming. So what did the general say when asked, why were there no planes in the air that morning to guard our buildings?
Well, they couldn't answer it. They said that the time just kept building up, that there was a delay. The main excuse that they were concentrating on planes that were coming in from overseas, and they had no idea it was going to happen within our borders. And of course, that's totally convoluted. It doesn't fit any of the testimony, any of the briefings and the reports coming from the briefing papers that have been leaked. And frankly, if you want to know the truth, I looked through those 28 pages of redactions, and in a couple spots, I thought, in my own personal opinion of just taking a look at it, that they left out the spot where that they had briefed somebody in the White House or even the president. And the key thing that I have already written, when I had an in the elevator conversation, there's a story about Senator Shelby. It's about two stories ago, and there's a picture of Senator Shelby and Senator Graham, both of whom I've written quite a bit about. And I interviewed them, took their picture, was right up on close to them, and talked to both of them personally. Graham for quite a bit in the morning, and I talked to Shelby And Shelby had said that the issue of the president's foreknowledge may have probative value. In other words, what he said is the briefings that were turned into the White House or that came from in July and on August the 6th particularly, which talked about planes flying into buildings. See, that's the critical thing. Those briefings may have probative value. That's a legal term meaning that they may have evidentiary value in a courtroom or in a, you know, in a legal venue of some sort.
Yes, but of course they can't say anything. In fact, I heard
Senator
Graham make a remark, I think it was on Face the Nation, when asked, well, and now what nation are we talking about? I mean, you tell us that they've blocked out all these pages. What nation is that? And Senator Graham's reply was, well, I can't tell you because I don't want to take that trip to the federal penitentiary as long as I'm running for the presidency and on my way to the White House. I can't tell you what nation it was. Now, everybody knows it's Saudi Arabia, but the senators are so cowed by this threat of imprisonment for leaking classified information that they're not even going to say what everybody else knows.
No, it's really incredible. And
how can we have a free and open society when even our duly elected representatives are restricted in the name of national security not to tell any of the evidence that we did nothing to stop that if we knew it was going to happen? Well, the question is, how do the generals deny the fact that they should have had fighter planes in the air at least to defend the Pentagon, and they didn't? What was the response?
It was just incredible. It was very poor. What they said, they were concentrating on the outside, planes coming in. They had no idea what was going to happen within the country, and they kept saying by the time the first plane, you know, it crashed, there kept being a delay, and that time just, it kept building and building until finally all four planes crashed, and they really didn't have any answer that made any kind of sense.
You think they were lying?
Of course, and the thing about it is, I talked to the one general who testified, and I can't think of his name now, it's been two or three months now, and the one general had said that he wouldn't say anything. He said, I can't tell you about what kind of defenses we had around the Pentagon. And there are missiles at the Pentagon that automatically are set.
They've had those missiles there for a long time.
Yes, they have.
They've already, of course, had the attacks on the two towers of the World Trade Center. And those missiles were not activated.
No, that's another key point. And he, literally, I asked him, I'm going to write about this. There's a little, you know, back and forth we had for about the 5 to 6 minutes, and there were a whole lot of reporters sitting there watching it too, and that never got reported in the press. You know, I've been writing story after story here, and this is, you know, I knew that I was going to have more than enough of these little tidbit stories that I could stick in other stories, and this one has not been reported anywhere, and I think it's a critical part of the whole thing.
Well, the big question is, why were there no planes up in the air? We know that when Payne Stewart's plane, the professional golfer, lost contact with the ground, where within a relatively few minutes there were fighter planes right next door to it, accompanying it until it crashed. So why, and here we are, maximum alert, we know there's going to be an attack on America, we know it's going to involve airplanes, and there are no fighter planes in the air that morning. There's only one way that could happen, and that is somebody gave an order.
The other thing was Joint Chiefs Staff Chairman, Acting Chairman Myers, because Tommy Franks was headed overseas to Europe conveniently, and Myers was in the office of Max Cleland, and he received the information that the first plane had hit the tower, and he said, well, let me know what happens, and he went in to meet with Cleland, and he didn't come out of the meeting until all four planes had crashed.
Now, is the man who's in charge of the American
military. He is the top military person on American soil, period, and no one went into his office and said, hey, General, second plane crashed. Hey, General, the third plane crashed. Hey, General, the fourth plane crashed. He didn't come out till the end out of Cleland's office. He was there.
That sounds like a cover story if I ever heard one. It's sort of like, you know, what happened to General Marshall's Catlett Marshall on the morning of December 7th, 1941? Well, he was out riding horseback. And, of course, what happened, of course, in the First World War to Sir Edward Grey? Well, he was fishing on that day when, of course, they could have avoided the First World War. He just
decided
to go fishing. And, you know, the fact that he, in the face, in maximum alert, knowing it's going to be involving planes, because there was all the evidence. There were government reports on it. There were intelligence reports on it. And then he's just not at his at his desk at all.
No, the other person, Rumsfeld, was told about the first plane. He went into his office, and he stayed there for about an hour to an hour and a half, and came out only after the Pentagon was hit. Now you have to remember here, and the same with Junior Bush. Junior Bush knew about the first plane was hijacked at 8:35 in the morning. Because the ABC News reporter, I can't think of his last name, on 8:35 it was reported that he heard another reporter say, "Mr. President, have you heard what's going on, what has been going on in New York City?" And see, they had already gotten word that, see, the first plane had been determined to be hijacked at 8:13 on 9/11. It was definitely determined to be hijacked at 8:20 when it disobeyed orders flying to the coast and flying at a 35,000 air height. That it made a 170-degree turn south towards New York City. In other words, totally disobeying, the flight control people and heading south toward New York City. So they knew that it was hijacked, and the flight control person that I've already written about this, I can't think of his name, said, from a couple of stories ago that they determined it to be hijacked. And so they were heading south to New York City, and so that was at 8:35 and at 8:20 in the morning. And we found out, and I have talked to, this is coming out of my next story, and I'll give you a little kind of a little scoop on this thing, what we found is I talked to the PR person of the FAA, Laura Brown, and she told me that there were phone bridges set up. In other words, at about 8:20 in the morning, the Secret Service, the Department of Defense, and all of the other, the FAA, NORAD, were all in phone conversation about this plane at 8:20 in the morning. Now, you have to remember, from 8:13 in the morning, it was 1 hour, and it was 1.5 hours before the third plane crashed, and 1 hour and 56 minutes from 8:13 until the collision of the last plane in Pennsylvania. So we have 1,600-mile-an-hour planes, and they couldn't shoot the last two planes down to save lives with an hour and a half and almost 2 hours notice. Now, the Secret Service, remember, Junior had Secret Service members all around him down there in Florida. So he would have known, he would have been told, he said he was told at 8:35. Now here it is, he's heading, this was in his car, this was before he even left. He was at 8:35, that was the time that he took off and left to go to the elementary school at 8:35 in the morning, got in his car. The plane crashed at 8:43, the first plane. So a plane had crashed. At 8:56, the third plane was determined to be hijacked. And the second plane was also, the third plane was determined at 8:56. They already knew about 8:30, 8:35 that the second plane was hijacked. So you had two more planes hijacked before he even went into the elementary school. And the Secret Service knew, people around him knew. They let him go into the room. He sat down, and at 9:06, he was told that the second plane had crashed. Now, this was after he knew the first plane crashed. He knew the second plane was hijacked. He knew the third plane was hijacked. And he sat down with the elementary school and was told that the third plane that the second plane had crashed, knowing that the third plane was still hijacked and still not going to crash for another 45 minutes or so, okay? And he still sits there for another 28 minutes chit-chatting with the goat people, about the goat story and the kids and the teachers. And during this time period, all of the media had rushed out of the classroom to cover the breaking story of the planes crashing on 9/11, and the president was still in there chit-chatting with the people, the teachers, and this is reported by 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different newspaper sources.
There
you have, Meyer sat in his office until all the four planes crashed. Junior stayed in the classroom until three of the planes had crashed, pretty much. I think he came out about the time the third plane crashed. And Rumsfeld stayed in his office till three of the planes crashed, for about an hour to an hour and a half.
Those
are the three perpetrators who could have had an effect.
Well, I think, of course, anybody can go up on the website of the Project for the New American Century, of which, of course, Donald Rumsfeld is one of the leaders. And if they're at the newamericancentury.org, pull down the report on rebuilding America's defenses, and if you read it through, you'll find at one place, and I think it's on page 51, although don't hold me on that, they talk about, of course, transforming our military, and it's going to take a long time to transform our military for the purposes of dominating the world, unless there is a catastrophic and catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor. Unless there is a catastrophic and catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor, get the report, find it, and of course remember Donald Rumsfeld was part of this little group waiting for another Pearl Harbor, and on the morning of September 11th it occurred, and of course he just wasn't anywhere to be found. Nobody was anywhere to be found. See, we don't know why none of those planes were in the air. We don't know who it was who bought up all the seats, because only about a quarter of the seats on those four planes were occupied. Did Osama bin Laden buy up all those seats so many Americans wouldn't be killed? And why did they tell the people in the South Tower to stay at their positions, not to evacuate, when they could see the people jumping out of the North Tower? Lots of questions, no answers. We'll be right back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Tom Flacco, and of course, we're talking about what really happened on September 11th. And Tom has been attending these meetings back there, the intelligence meetings. So really nothing's happening. Are they still holding the conferences, or are they still in executive session, or what?
After the conference basically is the testimony, the hearings. They're only going to have three or four more, and then they're going to go in secret session for the rest of the time and do interviews without public knowledge until they ultimately write their report. And their report is due out sometime next May, well before the election season gets going.
But of course, the administration, at least what we hear, is doing everything they can to block the information from getting out of the committee. And then, of course, the information will all be classified, so nobody can know what is in it. And then, of course, when they prepare the report, the administration will classify everything. That, of course, raises any question. So how are the American people going to get the truth?
Well, they're not. The loyal opposition, the Democrat Party, basically has thrown in the towel, and they're not even trying. There is some talk about getting a letter signed by senators to try and get the 28 pages. Frankly, I don't think there's that much on the 28 pages. There may be some politically embarrassing, a couple lines, a couple things here and there, I'm guessing, that might indicate that the president had seen some briefings or he was aware. I was going to say before that I talked to the lady who was in charge of
the investigation. You mean Eleanor Hill?
Eleanor Hill, right. Yes. Who was the Intelligence Committee's chairman, kind of the administrative supervisor and so forth. And I talked to her in an elevator, along with Porter Goss. Porter Goss just stood there with his mouth open. I was asking some pretty tough questions about Junior knowing, whether she was going to indicate whether the president had prior knowledge and had seen the briefings. She said, The briefings may not be classified, but the president's knowledge of the briefings is classified. Now, what do you think that means?
No, I think it means that we're not to know what he knew.
That's exactly.
Or when he knew it. But, of course, the question is not what the president knew. The question is, what did Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and the other members of this Project for the New American Century group that were looking forward to a catastrophic and cataclysmic event like a catalytic event like another Pearl Harbor, what did they know? And I think that we can focus on the president and not on the men who control the president. The president, really, I believe, is a figurehead for a power block there. In fact, they're embarrassed to give him a press conference by his own. They script everything for him, even the questions at the press conference, and even who he will ask for the questions at the press conference. So
And
the president, here we see this speech on the uranium from Niger. And he says, gee, I didn't know it was in the speech. And everybody else says, gee, we didn't know it was in the speech. Well, if the president doesn't know what's in the speech, what does he know? And the truth of the matter is, he is simply a figurehead for a power elite. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, yes. A couple of my pictures have Senior Bush as holding the strings as Bush is a marionette. But that's one of the pictures we've used for one of the stories. It just shows Junior kind of acting like a puppet.
And of course, everybody should know that George Herbert Walker Bush was the former director of the CIA, just exactly as Khrushchev was the former director of the KGB, and Putin came from the KGB, and Andropov came from the KGB. George Bush came from the CIA. He was a member of the Board of Directors of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a member of the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, the Vice President of the United States. Well, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and certainly our guest is Tom Flocko. We were just talking about George Herbert Walker Bush, who's really directing, I believe, most of what's going on today in concert with Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and all these other people who come from the Council on Foreign Relations.
You know,
Rumsfeld doesn't, but certainly Cheney does, and certainly Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and most of the hierarchy that are there, either skull and bones or Council on Foreign Relations people. And of course, they control the Clinton administration, they control the first Bush administration, they control the Reagan administration, they've controlled every administration going back to 1953. With very, very few exceptions. There, people are always in positions of power. So, but basically, the question that Tom had raised is, what did the president know, and when did he know it? And my comment was, I don't think it's important what the president knew. It's what the people around him knew, because I think a lot of things the president doesn't know anything about. He didn't know it, even what was his speech he was reading about the uranium coming from Niger. And, you know, I think that we should be very, very seriously concerned. When the president writes his speech, nobody knows what's in the speech. Who's really leading? Well, I believe that there's a group that's controlling the president, and he's simply playing his part. He plays it very well, and he does it makes a nice impression. But he always embarrasses them when he's not speaking from a script, and when he gets talking on his own with these homey expressions, which we like to hear, of course, but he's not saying what they want him to say.
Well, I feel that three of the perpetrators, Cheney, has been very quiet. Rumsfeld has been very quiet the last few weeks. Richard Myers, you hardly see him. This is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Myers and Rumsfeld had definite foreknowledge. There's just no question in my mind. They were involved. They had to have seen the briefings, their activities, what they did on 9/11, staying away from the fray, letting planes crash, and conveniently staying in offices and being kept busy. Myers in a case working on with Max Cleland. And interesting, look who shows up on the 9/11 commission but Max Cleland. Max Cleland was the one who was meeting with Myers in the office for that lengthy period of time when the last three planes crashed while he's in the meeting. And no one came into that Joint Chiefs chairman no one came into the office and said, "Mr. Chairman, we have a second plane crash."
We're under attack today. What should we do?
No,
we don't want to interrupt anybody.
And see, those people need to be questioned not by a senator, but by interrogators, you know, by people who are professionals and can ask them the tough kind of questions that can get the truth out of them. But
they're not going to tell. It would cost them their lives, their professions, if they did. Because this is a cover-up. It's exactly what happened at Pearl Harbor. It's exactly what happened with the murder, the assassination of President Kennedy. And, of course, if you go back and you study that, there were 109 people who knew something about it, and they all died under very mysterious circumstances.
The Six-Day War, too, with the Liberty got shot up, and they were going to blame that on Egypt.
Right.
Remember?
But, of course, the same pattern over again. The trouble is, of course, since the Fourth Estate, the media, has become a fifth column, nobody, of course, calls these people to do anything. And you mentioned, of course, that a lot of the media actually heard some of your conversations and never commented on it.
Nothing. I have no. I've not seen it. So, I'm going to write about it. Well, look, we're getting a tremendous, there's a lot of people coming to the site, TomFlocko.com. I'll say it again, we're getting a lot of traffic and there are a lot of people coming and reading the stories, and I get all kinds of letters like Greece and Russia and Turkey. I'm getting all over the place. People sending me emails. Just keep up the work, just keep writing, and just like you're doing, you're getting out there on the air, and more people, hear the story and hear what really happened. And if you start to put two and two together, this thing, the timeline alone, Stan, it just will not, is indefensible. If you really study the timeline, you'll see that they can't answer, for this total amount of time, an hour and a half to 2 hours that went by from the time they knew.
And well, I think it was a period of, now, at least according to Christian Breitweiser's testimony, an hour and 40 minutes from the time the first plane was hijacked until, of course, the plane crashed in the Pentagon, and then it was sometime after that, then, of course, the plane went down in Pennsylvania.
Well, the time the first plane crashed, maybe an hour. I counted it at 1 hour and 56 minutes from 8:13 all the way around till whatever it was, 10-something.
And that is when the last plane was shot up?
Yeah, the last plane impacted at about 10:01, 10:04, 5, something like that.
Well, we know it was a cover-up because of the passports. Yeah. I mean, they found one of the hijackers' passports 2 blocks away from the Pentagon, from the World Trade Center, and another hijacker's passport in Pennsylvania, and they even had a picture of that up on the FBI website, which we pulled down.
Well,
in other words, does anybody really believe that they rolled down the windows on the plane and threw out their passports before they crashed, or that the only thing that survived, that when the black boxes, nothing else survived, but of course those passports survived the fire inferno?
In the story that I just wrote.
We're going to have to take a quick break here as we go to the half hour. We'll be right back in just a moment here with Tom Falkel. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Tom Falkel. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you would agree or disagree, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. It was Thomas Jefferson who said so well, if a nation expects to be able to live both free and never will be. In other words, if the people don't know what's going on, why we're not going to be able to maintain our freedom. And of course, as somebody pointed out recently, in the Soviet Union, in Russia today, everybody who reads the newspaper knows it's manipulated and controlled, and everything they hear, of course, is simply propaganda. Here in the United States, the American people believe we have freedom of the press, and they think that they can believe at least part of what they read, and the great tragedy is you really can't. If it weren't for the Internet and people like Tom Falkel and, of course, alternative radio, you would get absolutely no truth here in America. The CIA has their agents planted in the media. The CIA has their agents planted in the publishing houses. The CIA has their agents planted in television. And if you doubt that, let me suggest a new book. It's called Fixing Intelligence by Odom. Who is Odom? General Odom, former head of the National Security Agency. And in that book, anybody wants the references, we have them. He mentions at least 2 places that there is a question whether or not it's proper for the CIA to have journalists planted in the media in America. Now, this is a very, very recent book, and the rest of the book is what I would say is not very exciting, but the fact that the head of the NSA, the National Security Agency, or sometimes referred to as no such agency, it's so secret. In fact, I've been told it's almost worth your life to know anything about that, and I was told that by a personal friend of mine who worked for NSA, and when he asked me what I knew about NSA, and I said, not very much, he said, that's much better, you're safer that way, or words to that effect. But when he talks about the CIA agents working within our media, I think every American should understand that we're not getting the truth. And we're not, in fact, the reporters who try to get the truth lose their jobs. And that's beautifully outlined in a book we carry called Into the Buzzsaw, 18 essays, 18 people in the media tried to tell their truth, Pulitzer Prize winners, Emmy Award winning.
I'm reading it right now.
Oh, and of course, they lost their jobs because they told the truth. What do you think of that book?
Well, I'm just starting it because I have an interview with the author that I'm doing, and I'm going to do a review of the book.
That's Christina Borgensen.
Yes.
Right. Have you actually seen the complete 900-page report?
No, I have actually looked at it and skimmed it.
Do you know if they put Christian Breitweiser's testimony in there? Because I thought that was some of the most devastating testimony I'd seen.
Well, the better testimony, even better than hers. Hers was the best. Hers was the first one. There was another, Mindy Kleinberg. Hers was the best as far as, and we have printed a little bit of that, and we have a link on one of our stories, going back, one of the Robert Graham stories. that I did, and I have a link to Mindy Kleinberg. You ought to take a look at that. Remember that name, Mindy Kleinberg.
All right, now how she's can we find her on your website?
She's one of the Jersey girls. Well, while we're talking here, I can probably cruise my site and find it. You know, it was one. I'll tell you when it was. It came right before when I went down there at. So I'd have to look for it.
I've been at your website. You've got so much material, and I'd get lost. So.
Oh yeah, you.
Maybe you could find that and let me know.
Oh well, we'll find it. It's here.
You don't have any idea how I could get hold of her and interview her, do you?
I'll get her email after we go off the air.
Get that to me because we'd love to get her and Kristen Breitweiser. But every time I try, it's almost as if there are people working within these family groups who are there specifically to prevent these people from getting onto the radio.
Yeah, they're interestingly enough, the ones they like to talk to the best are the mainstream media folks who are covering up the best. You know, and that's one of the problems that you're dealing with. I don't understand it, frankly, but it's just the way it is. You can't change something when they want to do it that way. And that's their, basically what they've done. Here it is, Mindy Kleinberg. You can go to the story on my website, TomFlanco.com. I found it for you here, and it's in the story called Bush May Invoke 9/11 Executive Privilege.
Okay,
Bush may invoke 9/11 executive privilege. There is a link to that testimony, and I have some of it actually where I actually copied it down, and there's three or four paragraphs that I used as an example, but there is a link to that within that story. Mindy Kleinberg, it was excellent. She was the most articulate so far that I've heard. Breitweiser had been the star of the Jersey Girls, the victim family members at North Jersey there. And there's another, Lori Van Alken is another very good one, Mindy Kleinberg, Patty Cazazza, Kristen Breitweiser, of course, and of course Steve Push. Now Steve Push is moving on. He's getting married. He's getting remarried. And, I sense the fact that he was kind of moving on with the whole thing. He's still interested and so forth. But, he's got a new love in his life. And after 3 years now, or two years, and things have changed for him. And this does happen.
Now, look, for our listeners out there, Stephen Push was the spokesman for this one group of families of the victims of 9/11.
Very outspoken.
And he did a good job. We have a number of interviews with Stephen, but of course, he's not going to be there. He had spent a lot of time and effort and a lot of emotion on this. But sometimes something like this becomes so overwhelming it just totally dominates your life, and then. The only way you're going to maintain your sanity is to get burnout, as it were.
Yeah, there's not going to be, if you think you're going to see, Cheney and Rumsfeld and Junior and Myers get let out in shackles, it'll never, ever, ever happen in a million years. The best you're going to get is maybe the fact that Junior might lose the election and be taken from power. But you're not going to see anybody let out in shackles. I would be flabbergasted if you got that kind of justice. And, of course, that's an absolute tragedy.
Well, let's ask a couple of questions. Did anybody bring up the fact that three-quarters of the seats in those two planes were empty that morning? In other words, somebody had to buy up those seats. They don't even bother to fly a plane if it's only 25% full. So three-quarters of the seats were empty.
I got another one for you. Did
anybody bring that up, though?
In this new story, and it's related to that, when my researcher Michael Thomas was threatened by that marshal, which is the new story we have up there. At the end of that story, I have a section, a subheading called "Wanted, Dead and Alive." Mary Schiavo, the Department of the Inspector General for the Department of Transportation, the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration. She was appointed by Senior Bush, and it was carried over into the Clinton years. But she basically talked with Thomas, and he was trying to tell her that he had found in his research from looking that two of the hijackers that the FBI produced within hours after the attack are currently working as commercial pilots for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
And in fact, there are six of them that are alive and well over there. And of course, the FBI keeps insisting that that they got the right people. There's an article in Insight magazine we can make available to anybody who wants it, where actually there's no question that some of these people are still alive.
But what Mary said was, she said, "I don't want to hear." Now, she is the one that represents 60 of the victim family clients. She has 60 clients who were on all four of the airplanes, the victim family members who had relatives, husbands, wives, relatives that were on the four planes, 60 families. And she said, she told Tom Michael that she didn't want to hear about any hijackers that might be alive. The quote was, "That's discovery that I don't want to know about. This is a case of negligence, and we wouldn't get any money if that were the avenue I took to prosecute the case. Do you understand? That's discovery." This is quotes. "I don't want to hear it." Mariani told us that Schiavo, that's Ellen Mariani, one of the victim families, she and Michael met for lunch with Schiavo. She put her hands over her ears, Mary Schiavo did. "I would have to report," she said, "that as discovery, evidence that many of the FBI's hijackers are still alive."
In other words, it was a scam. They, within 48 hours of the attack, they said, "We know who they are." And how did they know? Because of their passports. In fact, they found two passports, one close to the World Trade Center, one, of course, close to the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania site. So, you know, they say, "Well, we know who these people were. We found their passports." Does anybody really believe that they've rolled down the windows on the plane? Let's go to Neil here in Washington. Hi, Neil. How are you doing?
Well, Dr. Stan, how are you?
Doing fine.
I totally agree with your guest and agreement on this 9/11, but what I want to talk to you about, you had September 2nd, 2002, last year, you had Chuck Missler as your guest on your program.
Right. Well, now, is this having anything to do with our conversation here tonight? Or?
No.
All right. What did you want to ask?
Well, you know, you call me anti-Semitic on that particular...
Neil, I really don't want to get off on another subject. I mean, you have right to your views, but we're talking about, you know, the 9/11 issue and what happened that day, I really don't want to get into that. If you'd like to call me off the air, I'd be glad to talk to you.
Well, how can I call you off the air?
Well, of course, you can call, and I'll just go ahead and have my producer take your telephone number, and then I'll call you back, okay?
Okay.
All right, fine.
All right,
so hang on. Would you please pick up this telephone, please? Dale, go ahead and pick up the number, and I'll give him a call back. But I really don't want to get on to another subject at present time. So, go ahead.
Well, the government, Michael Thomas said the government's going to have to pay billions. They would have to pay billions for a cover-up that they're committing. If he delivers the dead hijackers, can you imagine two or three of these hijackers showing up in the courtroom in New York City alive? And as commercial pilots?
Well, of course, they will probably say, and I'm sure that what they are saying is that, of course, these gentlemen, that somebody had stolen their identity, and that's why they thought who they were really wasn't who they really were. But the most amazing thing, they had their pictures, they knew everything about them. But just within 2 days of the attack, in fact, according to Kristen Breitweiser, they knew who most of them were within 2 hours of the attack. And that's why I just wonder if her testimony was classified after she gave it.
It's quite incredible. We found that there was a secret meeting during the litigation before the second hearing on Friday, May 20th, 2002. A secret meeting was held for a few hours right before a critical meeting where Judge Hellerstein, the judge in the 9/11 litigation, initiated limits, which severely affected the evidence discovery in the case for the victim families.
Now, this is the people who are suing. Are they suing the
airlines? They're only really suing the airlines and the security firms. They're not allowed to sue the United States government.
Well, how about suing Saudi Arabia for finding the airlines?
They are doing that, you see. But again, when you get involved in that, that has nothing to do with going after the government, the CIA, the FBI. you know, the borders, the issuance of visas to terrorists. I don't know if you've talked about that.
Oh, yes. I've even talked to one of the fellows who was ordered by the CIA to issue the visas to people who were terrorists. But, of course, you know, there is just so much of a cover-up. Of course, one advantage of the lawsuits is, of course, you can get people in, you can get discovery, you can get people to testify under, under oath.
Yeah, what they're doing.
Perjury.
What they're doing is the government, through the TSA, Transportation Security Administration, has lawyers from the Justice Department that have taken over the case, basically, and they're invoking sensitive security and national security so that they've basically put roadblocks for the discovery request. That's what the judge has allowed. And you've got to remember here that the judge is an expert in RICO suits. We mentioned that right up front. He's written he's written a number of legal briefs. He has total control over the litigation here. And we found, you know, the fact that the victim families are allowed to sue the government under the RICO statutes when one or more persons has been harmed or, you know, has had damage done to him by any number of ongoing enterprises. And of course, this whole RICO issue is an area of expertise of Alan Hellerstein, who is the judge that controls the case. And basically, he is in a situation where no one has seen his picture. Michael is trying to get his picture from Mary. You can't find when he was confirmed to the bench and his confirmation hearing, any of the things about the questions that were asked. We called the UPI and AP, can we get a picture for the story? They don't even have any pictures, and it's like, you know, we found that there were government officials at this meeting. We know that to be rock solid because we heard descriptions of the type of security at this hotel meeting, and we know that. So what the question being is, why are the lawyers who are representing the victim families meeting at a hotel room with government officials, basically, who are on the other side of the table, you know, and why are they meeting outside of the courtroom? And we found this out through Mrs. Mariani, but also from a source that we have. We can't mention it's within the government, and we can't say where, otherwise that, you know, we're going to get to the point where someone will find out who it is.
All right, now, of course, you were trying to get a picture of the judge to put on one of your articles. Was that it?
Yes, I was.
You were then, of course, your investigator was approached by a U.S. Marshal. Under what guise?
Yeah, he said that he said we have been told that you were trying to obtain a picture of the judge and had threatened the judge. Now, there was only one person that knew that Michael Thomas lived in Phoenix, and that was Mary Schiavo, because she's the only one. It was either the judge or somebody that one of those two put up to it to give him a call to say, do not go to New York, do not threaten, do not research for the website. You know, we might put restrictions on any type of book or any other thing you might write. And so he's basically trying to intimidate him. His name was Steve Borak, a U.S. Marshal in Phoenix. So we found out that Marshal Borak worked in New York City for 10 years, so he's linked that way to Judge Hellerstein. He's linked to Hellerstein and at least to New York City. And Mary Schiavo, as the former United States attorney before she became an assistant U.S. attorney, before she became the Inspector General appointed by Senior Bush, she represented the United States Marshal's Office and told us that she still had connections in Washington, D.C.
Is she representing the families in this suit?
Well, we went to another Bush administration official who told us point blank that Mary Schiavo was acting as damage control in the whole matter.
Well, I would point out that, of course, what happened with the victims of Waco, why are these lawyers came in and said, we want to represent you against the government, and they were on the other side. Some of these people were actually government employees pretending to represent the people and fighting the cases to lose. A pretty standard operating procedure. I've seen it happen over and over again. This is what happened to Elian Gonzalez and the family that was down there in Florida. And the people, of course, who came to them and said, why, we're lawyers, boy, we want to help you, were actually working for Janet Reno, and one of the gentlemen had been appointed to a key position by Janet Reno, but the families are unsophisticated, and they're just looking for somebody who will represent them,
right.
And of course they don't realize they're being betrayed. The other side is so clever, they know exactly how to manipulate people, and of course get them all involved in something that of course will accomplish absolutely nothing. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to talk on this subject. But please don't call with something extraneous that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, because it really does spoil the flow of the program. So now, of course, as you are in the front lines of this battle, Tom, and of course you're trying to get the information out, and of course you're trying to get people to understand what's happening, and you have a very good website. It's tomflocco.com, is it, .org?
Any one of them. Don't go to any award. Net.
Tom Flocco, FLOCCO.
.com.
Material fascinating.
.com's good.
.com, okay. Yeah. And I'll ask Dale if he'll pick up the other line there, please, that is calling in. So, okay, who do we have on the line?
It's Mike.
Hiya, Mike. Yeah, question or comment?
Question. Given all the disinformation we've got surrounding all this with the airplanes in New York, why should we believe that there were actually hijackers on the airplanes?
Well, of course, that's a good question. That's a possibility that nothing is as it appears to be.
Well,
Most people believe that there were there. Most people believe we know that they have the ability to control airplanes, you don't even have to have a pilot on board anymore. But we just don't know.
Stan, here's my question. All I want to do is please let me see the financial records of the ticket purchases. Please let me talk to and interview the boarding gate personnel who saw the Arab hijackers, unquote, get on the planes. You know, and please let me hear the transmissions between the cockpit the cockpit transmission between the flight controllers and the pilots. Because I need to have somebody say, yes, I saw 5 Arab guys get on this plane. I saw 4 get on that plane. I saw 5. We've not heard any of that yet. I think that's what your caller is trying to refer to.
It may very well be there are lots of strange things going on that are so impossible, Mike, that the average person is not going to believe them.
Mm-hmm.
But our job is to try to get people to think, and your job is to raise those impossible questions, okay?
Well, I have one more.
Okay, go ahead.
Everybody's wondering, you know, what did Bush know, what did Cheney know, and everybody else. My question is, what did Hillary know?
What does Hillary have
who knows?
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mike, what they're trying to do is shape the issue. And, of course, they want us to get us focusing on something that's totally unimportant. They want us to focus on the 16 words in the president's speech. And, of course, by so doing that, and we focus all of our attention on it, we've missed everything else that's going on today. And when people understand how they play games with our minds, at that point we can begin to think effectively.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you one while we're talking real quick here. The issue of this deals with Schiavo, because Schiavo and I talked a year ago, and I can confirm that regarding the insider trading, the issue of profiting from prior knowledge by executing put options and bets that certain companies were going to tank the airline companies, or even just selling off stock because you could generate a fortune that way. Schiavo said to me, and this is a quote, "Tom, that's a great idea to go after the documents connected to the pre-attack insider trading profits from the Securities Exchange Commission's control list. That's the still confidential, not for public consumption, list of stock trading profits in the weeks and months prior to 9/11 involving companies directly affected by the attacks." She said, "I agree that none of the information contained in that control list from the SEC would be related to national security. It could be even used for punitive damages." Well, after a year later, court documents indicate that Schiavo and the other attorneys representing the families have not sought discovery or evidence discovery from the SEC regarding that confidential list, regarding the issue of treasury notes, billion-dollar treasury notes, dumping stocks,
purchasing put options or bets that, that stocks would tank in the airlines and so forth, the airline industry, and also in the towers and the insurance companies overseas, French AXA, Munich Re, Swiss Reinsurance. All of those companies took tremendous dives, and if you knew ahead of time, you could have made a fortune, and a lot of them did, and they have the records of who made a lot of these trades, and I'm beginning to find out. I have another source that told me yesterday that a huge multi-million dollars of trades were not reported on Bloomberg News to the Chicago Board of Options, and I'm waiting to get some documents. There are documents out there which lead to that, and we're going to put them online so that the public can read them.
All right. There were both a lot of puts and sold, or I guess of options. No, there would be puts, wouldn't they? I can't keep track. The puts are forward and options are losses. How does it work?
The put options were bets that a stock was that you could buy a stock at its original price or buy it at the price that it tanked to.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, basically, there was a lot of this that went on in Europe as well as here in the United States. And we have articles written and referring to the fact that the head of the German bank, central bank, and the head of the French central bank said, you know, obviously somebody had advanced knowledge because they were shorting American Airlines, United Airlines, J.P. Morgan, and I'm sure
companies in the towers.
Right.
Companies in the towers.
Right, and so, and of course, the same thing was happening here in the United States. Now, you would think that that would be a very obvious. I mean, who knew ahead of time? Let's track it down, and nobody.
Yeah, all we're hearing is 16 words. 28 pages and nothing about the U.S. Securities Exchange Commission control list of prior knowledge insider trades. Nothing, nothing, nothing. And it's a tragedy and a crime that's going on here, and we need to hear this information.
Okay, Mike, anything else?
Please let us know if BCCI shows up anywhere on your list.
Well, BCCI is long since gone. That was the banks of crooks and congressmen, you know. That was actually the CIA fraud that was used.
Bank of Crooks and Criminals International.
Yeah, well, any of the individuals involved.
Thanks very much, Mike. Okay, fine. Well, so if you're out there in the listening audience, and of course it seems pretty incredible that, you know, anybody would even dare suggest that maybe it isn't exactly as we're told. If any of you who have not yet read Operation Northwood, we have copies of that, or you can get that in a book we carry called... by James Bamford, going into the background of the NSA, but he talks about the Operation Northwood, and we actually have that in my syllabus, Iraq, The Untold Story, the copy of the official, formerly top secret document, where the Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1962 had said, how are we going to get into a war with Fidel Castro? And of course, they had all sorts of ideas like, we'll sink some of our ships, or we'll have a lot of our people killed. But the story that it really intrigued me was so apropos, and I have this, if you want to read it, what we're going to do is we're going to take an airplane, and we're going to fill it full of people who are supposedly students going home to South America for the summer. And that plane is then going to fly over Cuba, except it's not going to be that plane. It's going to be another plane that looks like that plane. And, of course, what we're going to do is your plane is going to be flying, and it's going to drop down below the radar, and another plane is going to come up, and it's going to fly over Cuba. And when it gets over Cuba, it's going to put on a mayday call and say we're under attack by Cuban jets. And then the bomb in the plane is going to go off, and the plane is blown up. And, of course, everybody's going to think all of the students were on board, and they were really all just actors anyway. And, of course, we'll have a justification for going to war. That plan was actually sent all the way up to President Kennedy, who said, no way we're going to go along with that. And, of course, if you'd like to get either the book by James Bamford, or if you'd like to get a copy of Operation Northwood, we can tell you how to get it. It's rather long. You can go to the U.S. government archives, or you can get it from Radio Liberty. That's Operation Northwood. Could that be possible? Well, let's go quickly to Bill Justin before we run out of time. Bill, do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, Dr. Stan, wanted to ask the guest if in these lawsuits and everything, if anybody has use discovery or depositions of the fireman and that guy from Arizona that was the explosives expert. There's always talk out there and evidence showing that the firemen say they heard pops and explosions and then the building.
Nothing on that. No, that's a definite no, because that's going to ring up Oklahoma City problems. There's no question that those those buildings were imploded.
That was my first thought when I saw it on TV.
Everybody that saw that second building, we all saw that second building, when it went down first, Tower 2, South Tower, went down first. Man, that thing looked so like an implosion. It looked like an old Atlantic City casino hotel that was being imploded to get ready to build a new one.
But, of course, you can argue that, but pretty hard to explain Building 7 go down. I mean, that
Building 7 went down, right. That was where all the...
From the bottom, just like those, and we actually have pictures of that.
Do your listeners know what was in Building 7?
That was a CIA building, was it?
That's where all the investigation materials for the Securities and Exchange was. All of the investigations were in that building.
All the stuff
that blew up on its own. That blew up on its own with no, just blew up. You know,
it just sort of imploded, just like those.
Nothing crashed into it.
Bill, we're out of time. Do you want to call back after the hour?
Just one quick question: does the guest have a book out or anything, or going
to
put out?
I don't have a book. Just go to my website. You know, if you want to buy something, send us a donation to keep us online. You know, all that information's on the site at the bottom of the story.
Thank you very much. Good talking to you, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Thanks very much. And we'll be back here in just a few minutes here at Radio Liberty. Yes, we'll be back in just a minute, Tom. I'm just saying right on.
I'll give you those emails.
She had it right there. Oh, okay. Wait a minute. Oh, yes, okay, fine. Tell him we get Karen Lee on. Here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our colleagues. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we're going to have with us one of my favorite guests. First is Karen Lee Bixman, the investigative reporter. And, of course, we'll be talking about, well, we're going to be talking about her latest article. And, of course, Karen Lee always has some fascinating, fascinating material for us. Karen Lee, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing just great. How are you, Doctor?
I'm doing just fine. And, of course, we're going to talk about your article. We're going to talk about that article and what's happening in the financial markets across the world, and, of course, what's happening to our industry here and our job market.
Yes, so we're going to talk about the unemployment situation in this country.
All right, fine. And, of course, you know, I read the most amazing article. It was just a four lines on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And it just said that within the last 3 years, 1 in 5 Americans has lost his job, and most of them lost their jobs without benefits. That's really a rather frightening figure, and, of course, especially disastrous for especially many older people who suddenly are thrown out of work and, of course, cannot get a good-paying job. So you pick up the story from there.
Well, the article that I've done this month, I've actually titled this In the Eye of the Storm, because I believe that we are right in the midst of a financial hurricane. I really believe that we're in the early stages of a deflationary depression. I think this all started when the NASDAQ fell in March of 2000. But, you know, every day, Dr. Stan, we watch the news and everyone touts the economy or the stock market and they say everything is just great. But it's not just great. And what I've done is focus in on the fact that Americans are losing so many jobs that there's no way that this economy is going to be turned around. And I've focused a little on NAFTA and GATT. I would say that aside from the Federal Reserve, I don't think there is any other legislation that's had such a devastating effect on the U.S. economy. Just the manufacturing jobs, there's been over 800,000 jobs lost to NAFTA and GATT. And pretty much people have just been content. They thought, okay, well, fine. You know, we're getting all these products from China. The manufacturing base is literally gone. But most white-collar people have been very smug and think, well, I don't have a problem with my job. But that's not the case anymore. The newest jargon within the corporate arena is a term called outsourcing. And actually, outsourcing is a method where major corporations take high-paying jobs, positions in America. Those jobs are eliminated and then transferred overseas to lower-wage workers. And there are many countries that are doing this, but probably one of the most prominent is India. And there are huge new technology parks outside of all of India's major cities. And there is not hardly a corporation anymore that is not outsourcing jobs to India. You have your major corporations, Hewlett-Packard, American Express, Dell Computer, Citibank, Boeing. Different mortgage lenders now are having refis done, the paperwork done in India. Massachusetts General Hospital, they're even having their CT scans examined in India. Architectural firms, accounting firms. It is incredible the amount of white-collar work that was once done in the United States and is now being done overseas. And the sad thing is, as one of these executives stated, he says within the next 5 years there's going to be more than 4 million service jobs that are gone overseas, and once they leave the country, of course, they never come back. So we have a very tragic situation here, and for example, people don't realize, I use the example of American Express. Let's say if you called and had a problem with your credit card, you call, you don't realize that your call is being transferred to a call center in India because these people are trained in English, they have the English names, and you'll sit there and talk to someone about your bill and not realize that you're talking to a foreigner in a foreign country. And so we are to a point now that the way jobs are leaving, you know, overseas. One of the congressmen on the 18th of June, Donald Mazzulla, he had a hearing and on what was going on here with these jobs being outsourced overseas. And he said, you know, the assumption of NAFTA and GATT, that these were just going to be lower-paying jobs, they wouldn't affect anyone. But he said, now what do you do? What do you tell the PhD, the engineer, the architect, the accountant, or computer scientist? What do you do? What do you tell them to go? I mean, when their positions are being eliminated and sent overseas. So this program in itself is very tragic. But then along with NAFTA and GATT, we have the L-1 visa program. And I don't know how many people are familiar with the L-1 visa program, but what this allows, again, the major corporations to use this, they take and hire an employee in a foreign country, Asia, India, wherever, they bring that person over to the United States, and on the L-1 visa, they actually can stay in the United States for 7 years. Then what they will do is take and fire the American employee, And then this foreign worker now is used to replace the American worker.
And, of course, this is, of course, the transferring of our jobs to foreigners. And what this is going to do is force the living standards of the average American down. And, you know, currently, the thing that really bothers me is the average American really can't believe that we're being betrayed by the leaders of both political parties who have an agenda. And that is, of course, the Marxist concept, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And, of course, the American people have so much, and the people of the rest of the world have so little. And what we're going to do is transfer the wealth of America and raise the living standards here to that of the Mexican peasant. But, of course, we're not going to really raise the Mexican peasant that far, because you don't help the weak man by weakening the strong man. And this is exactly what the plan is. Of course, they're not going to redistribute the wealth of the very wealthy, not the Bushes or the Rockefellers or the Fords or the Carnegies or these people of great wealth who are so intent upon this one world order. Of course, what they're going to do is do away with our jobs, and then, of course, people, once they lose a job, will have to take a lower-paying job or maybe perhaps not have a job at all.
Well, you know, it's absolutely true, because on the NAFTA, within NAFTA and GATT, with the outsourcing, you know, what's going on is American jobs are being eliminated here. Let's say somebody's making $80,000 a year. They outsource that job to India, and that person can make $12 an hour in India, which is considered a very good wage. Now, there's no way that an American worker can sit and make $12 an hour and live and keep their head above water in our present-day economy. But what this is about is major corporations, the majority, I believe, our CFR members and also Trilateral Commission and so forth, definitely one-worlders. They are out to make a huge profit. They don't care about workers. If you talk to the heads of these corporations, they will not tell you that their companies are American companies. They will say, well, we're global companies and we just happen to be based in our head office in the United States, but we're not American companies. Well, and people don't realize with these different treaties and agreements, like, for example, this L-1 visa program. Now, Congress has been exercising a little talk about this, and one of the congressmen, Rosa DeLauro, earlier this month, actually, she introduced legislation to try to curtail this L-1 visa program. The problem is, though, what Congress, I'm sure they do realize, but the American public do not realize, we have now the Singapore Free Trade Agreement, and then we've got the Chile Trade Agreement, Free Trade Agreement. Well, these are similar to NAFTA and GATT. We call them, you can say, agreements. In essence, they are treaties. And the way the laws have, the courts have ruled that treaties every time supersede American law, even though that's unconstitutional. That's the way they have been ruling. But there are provisions within the Singapore Free Trade Agreement that actually prevent Congress from even regulating or eliminating this L-1 visa program. And the same provisions are in this Chile Free Trade Agreement as well. And anyone knows, I mean, if you look back to NAFTA and GATT, there was no recourse on that. We can't go back and change anything that was done in NAFTA and GATT.
And once you're in these things, you're stuck in them forever. And this is all part of a long-range plan. In fact, you can go back and you can read an article in Foreign Affairs in April of 1974, written by Rhodes Scholar Richard Gardner, member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he talks about how we're going to have to do an end run around the Constitution and then erode it bit by bit. And he talks about GATT and the World Trade Organization and the Law of the Sea Treaty, all these international agreements to, of course, undermine our way of life. And, of course, because they don't want the American people to know that their intent is to destroy our Constitution, to destroy our freedom, and to establish this world government under the control of the ruling elite, which was, of course, the dream of Cecil John Rhodes, and that's why Rhodes scholars like Richard Gardner and Bill Clinton and the others go right along with that. And, of course, then when they come back from Oxford, they join the Council on Foreign Relations. And that, of course, is the tie-in of this whole movement. And, of course, they can't let the American people know 10 years ago you never heard about the Council on Foreign Relations. 15 years ago, I had a researcher go through the communist papers over a period of 20 years. We could never find mention of the Council on Foreign Relations. Gee, why the communists supposedly against this military-industrial complex? Why wouldn't they ever write about it? Well, who do you think funds communism?
I had a quote in here, Dr. Stan. You know, we have a president in office whose intent, just like Bill Clinton was, to push all these free trade agreements, and Bush wants to continue to push for free trade with all of Latin America. But I had a quote in here from 1848 from Karl Marx, and he was asked about the question of free trade. I'd like to read this quote if I could.
Please do. I think that is the most important quote I've read in a long time.
Okay. It said, "But in general, the protective system of our day is conservative, while the free trade system is destructive. It breaks up old nationalities and pushes the antagonism of the proletariat and the bourgeoisie to the extreme point. In a word, the free trade agreement hastens the social revolution. It is in this revolutionary sense alone, gentlemen, that I vote in favor of free trade."
And, of course, really what he's saying is that, the poor people get, of course, increasingly impoverished, then they're going to agitate against the government, and, of course, that's exactly what the people in power want. And then, of course, out of the agitation, they can declare an authoritarian society in the name preserving freedom. They know exactly what they're doing, and what the most difficult thing for the average individual to realize is that many wealthy people are Marxists, not because they wanted to redistribute their wealth, they want to redistribute your wealth.
Well, Dr. Stan, the situation with jobs going overseas, I think, is just, and being eliminated through the L-1 visa program, it's downright scary. I have a quote from a consulting firm, A.T. Kearney, Andrea Brzee. And she says, "The debate at major financial service companies today is no longer whether to relocate some business functions, but rather which ones and where." And she says, "Any function that does not require face-to-face contact is now perceived as a candidate for offshore relocation." Now, along with what we're seeing in NAFTA and GATT and the L-1 visa program, we have a situation, an ongoing situation, which has worsened with the illegal immigration situation as well. We've heard many figures. I believe the figures are probably higher than what the U.S. Census Bureau quotes, but they state that there's 8.7 million illegal aliens living in the country. And people would traditionally think, oh, well, that's okay. They're out picking cotton or lettuce in the Imperial Valley of California, and they're not hurting my job. Well, those illegals now have just about taken over the maintenance, tourist, and service industries. Here in California, we saw the construction industry just totally decimated by the illegal immigration situation. But now people are starting to feel this in other parts of the country. And there's new corporations, some of these million-dollar corporations known as labor brokers. And what these labor brokers do, they hire illegal aliens, and they move them from city to city, state to state, to fill huge construction demand. For example, you can have a major, let's just say a major building going up, or let's just say Kemper Insurance is going to build a building in Minneapolis, all right? Kemper Insurance would hire one of these labor brokers, and the labor broker provides all the labor for that building. This broker would sign illegal aliens as contract workers. So that way they are not having to pay regular payroll taxes, overtime, Social Security, none of those things at all. The company itself doesn't have to deal with who's hired, and they just pay the labor broker. Well, these labor brokers have found that there's a loophole, actually, within the law, that you do not have to have a Social Security number if you work someone and issue them a W-9 IRS form. So if you work them as a contract worker, they don't need a social security number. So what you have then are just masses of illegals being shifted, as I say, from state to state, city to city, working on these major projects. And of course now, throughout the country, people in the construction field are just in an uproar because they can see their jobs being replaced. You know, Dr. Stan, way back in the early 90s when we were trying to get 187 passed in California, then of course it was overturned by the courts, people in the rest of the country just sort of yawned and said, oh, well, yes, you know, that's California, and they have a problem, but it doesn't affect us. Well, now the rest of the country is being affected by this mass of illegal immigration. And I always say, Dr. Stan, that California is a bellwether state. Whatever happens out here, I think people can look to their own state within 5 years, and they're going to have the same situation occur.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that people have to understand that they are specifically not sealing our border to flood all of the illegals in here. And I don't blame, if I lived in Mexico, I would want to come to America and get a, you know, much better wage. And life is so much easier here than it is in Mexico. But, of course, what this does is destroy this country. And that's why neither the Bush nor the Clinton administration will close the border. Because, of course, they want to drive the wages down. But, of course, they can't tell the American people that. Well, the American people would be furious if they realized that the leaders of both parties are controlled by exactly the same people, and their loyalty is not to America, but to this internationalist dream. And at that point, people can begin to understand what's going on, and hopefully, of course, can begin to take action.
Well, you know, I maintain that through these different programs that I've mentioned, NAFTA and GATT, the treaties, the O-1 visa, illegal immigration, since I have done this story, Dr. Stan, I have not been able to think of one American job that could not be replaced from these three venues. And I say that, somebody mentioned to me, oh, police officers or firemen. I really recently read an article about the firefighters program in the state of Oregon, how they have a minority program now where they're replacing regular firemen on the line. They're taking these minorities. The majority of them are from Mexico. They do not speak English. They're paying them probably a third of what the Oregon firefighters were making. And now they're having a lot of problems because English, of course, is spoken over the radio. And when these firefighters are on the line, wait, they can't speak English.
All right, fine. Well, who do we have calling in?
Mike again.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
I just want to ask a question. From what Karen is saying, it seems possible that U.S. corporations are funding illegal border crossings?
Well, I think that Tyson was actually charged with that, Tyson Meat Corporation, and I don't know what the outcome of that was, but they probably bought off a judge or something. But there was a serious question that they were actually bringing in illegals from Mexico to work in their meat plants. Yes.
Well, yes, and I did a few years ago an article, which I still carry at the Investigative Reporter, but I did a complete story on illegal immigration, who was behind it, the major corporations, for example, the Ford Foundation is one of the main funders of NECHA and La Raza, these militant immigration organizations. There's a whole list of major corporations that actually fund these illegal groups. So there's no doubt whatsoever that these major corporations are funding illegal immigration.
In fact, we even carry a book called Importing Revolution, and it goes into the fact the Ford Foundation, of course, has funded this whole illegal immigration movement. Why would you fund people violating our laws? Because you have a different agenda. You have a different worldview, and you're going to use the vast funds of the Ford Foundation, of course, to push that. And, of course, you have to understand that, of course, the Ford Foundation has a great deal of the stock in the Ford Motor Company. And, you know, I hate to see Ford getting into trouble, but maybe it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world because, of course, the proceeds from the Ford Motor Company go to the Ford Foundation that is intent upon destroying America.
Speaking of Tyson, Ask another question?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I believe it was in the last year or two of Bill Clinton's administration.
Right.
And I believe it was South Korea. All the chickens were deemed unfit for human consumption.
They had some sort of a disease, and they killed them all, and then, of course, Tyson got the contract.
Who just happened to be there with enough available chicken to resupply South Korea.
Isn't that interesting? What a fortunate coincidence for Tyson Company.
Amazing.
All right. Anything else, Mike?
That's all, thanks.
All right, thanks. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Our guest is Karen Lee Bixman, the investigative reporter. And Karen Lee, would you please give out your email and your address, or how people can get hold of you and get your monthly publication?
Sure, Dr. Stan. Those who do not know, I publish The Investigative Reporter. It does come out once a month. And if people are interested in subscribing or want information, they can call our office, and that number is 909-506-2781. That's 909-506-2781.
All right, and that's Karen Lee Bixman. And, of course, that is, of course, The Investigative Reporter, and it's an excellent publication. I always look forward to getting it every month when it comes. Well, of course, you know, this is really something people don't understand. These jobs are leaving America, not temporarily, but they're leaving it forever. And, you know, there's variations in the estimates of the number of jobs, but I've been told by people, and I know you used the figure, what, about 700,000 over how long a period?
That was 800,000. That's just manufacturing jobs that have been eliminated from NAFTA. But that figure doesn't include the jobs now that are being outsourced. That doesn't include jobs that are being eliminated through illegal immigration.
Now, that figure seems to be awfully low, that 700,000 from NAFTA. Is that a government figure, or where did it come from?
Actually, this is one of the U.S. economists in Washington by the name of Robert Scott. But consider that he's saying 800,000 jobs through NAFTA. Most of the economists or the pundits in Washington, I mean, I even read figures where they're saying only 90,000.
Well, I actually have talked to the people who work with Roger Milliken, and they say about 2.7 million since Bush came in alone. And, you know, we've talked to Mr. Gill, of course, who heads this organization on free trade, and he has a tremendous amount of information, but he's been quite ill recently, unfortunately. But, you know, I think that they are playing down the number of jobs.
Oh, I totally agree. I totally agree. But
they're moving,
you know, to try to find someone in Washington to even say that the economy or jobs have been affected by NAFTA and GATT is very difficult to do.
Well, Will, if you give me a call off the air, I'll give you John Nash's telephone number. And they're right on the front lines of this whole battle, and they're really watching this thing because, of course, they've decimated the textile industry. They've decimated the steel industry. They've decimated the electronic industry, and increasingly our electronics is going overseas. And this is what people don't understand. These jobs are not coming back again.
Well,
prosperity,
we know,
is not coming back again, and they're keeping the market up artificially. The plunge team is in there. They're trying to keep things looking pretty good until after the election next year, and then, well, then, of course, hang on to your hat.
Well, you know, this is another thing that's very contrary with the economy right now. We have what's being called a jobless recovery, which is an oxymoron if I've ever heard one, Dr. Stan. Right now, the statistics state that 6.4% unemployment. People don't, again, they may not realize that I believe our unemployment is probably double that 6.4% because different criteria are involved. When someone loses their job and they have exhausted their unemployment benefits, then they fall off the rolls. Well, they're no longer considered unemployed. If you have someone who's been working full-time and has not been able to get full-time work, has only employed part-time, they're considered, you know, they're not considered unemployed. And it doesn't matter if you used to make $80,000 a year, at Microsoft and now you're flipping McDonald's hamburgers for $7 an hour, you're still considered employed. So I think these figures are being puffed. They do not show, in actuality, the true unemployment figure in the country. But a year ago, I think it was last June of 2002, out of Washington, and a lot of the Wall Street pundits started talking about this jobless recovery. And, you know, everywhere you read the newspapers, the magazines, you turn on the TV news, oh, the economy is great. Well, you know, they had to come up with something to really put up a smokescreen for the American people, because anybody with a brain at all could see that more and more people were losing their jobs. The economy wasn't turning around. So they came up with this oxymoron called a jobless recovery, and it's ludicrous. There is no such thing as a jobless recovery. An economic recovery has not taken place at all. I maintain, and what I've done through this story, I have done an analogy of a hurricane and called this a financial hurricane, because I've maintained that since 2000, we've had the eye of the storm just sort of hanging over the United States. And people who know about a hurricane eye know that it's very calm on the inside of the hurricane eye. You can see blue sky, stars. And so, you know, people just keep looking up to the sky, and they see the blue sky, and they think everything's fine. Well, you know, within that eye, we have different little air pockets, bubbles, if you will. We have the credit bubble, the housing bubble, the derivative bubble, the bond bubble. All of these, air is going to be deflated, all of those, and we're just going to have an explosion on the backside of this hurricane.
I'm afraid you're right. We've got Mary calling from Covina, and we want to get that before we go to the break. Mary, did you have a question?
Yes, I'm so angry when I think about the disloyalty of the corporations and the products that we have bought from them, and I'm wondering, can we do anything that would we even make an impact if we just really stopped buying,
Yes, we would have an impact. Well, we need, of course, to have enough people who really understand which are the traitorous corporations and which are those that are loyal to America. And, of course, unfortunately, they're in a very definite minority. But, yes, we can have an impact, and I think Ford is beginning to feel that impact very definitely as we talk and try to get people to understand that their money is going to the Ford Foundation that's destroying America. You want to hang on until after the break?
Okay.
Yeah, we'll be here in just a minute, hopefully. I think that's a very, very fitting piece of music there. That wasn't exactly the one I wanted, but I think that tells us pretty well what's going on today, and we hope that many of you there will recognize that we got some real problems in America. Well, anyway, let's go to Mary. And Mary, did you have anything you else wanted to say?
Well, would we really, I know we would have an impact, but would we actually hasten our demise? Would we hurt our economy if we, I mean, right now I don't have to buy anything.
I could suggest, if you don't have to buy anything but food, don't buy anything, because right now you better get yourself in a good, solid financial position, because we're in real trouble as a nation, and of course the people are not making the preparations now. I fear we're going to lose everything. So get out of debt and then sit back. But of course, most of what you buy is going to be made in communist China or in Mexico or someplace else.
I remember a few years ago at Christmas time when they were saying don't buy anything from China, and of course Walmart, almost everything comes from China. Should we boycott Walmart?
Well, it would be great if we could, but you'd need, about 20 million people doing it. Let's build up our basis of support and understanding what this is all about. And, you know, when, of course, you have enough people behind you, why, even Walmart will listen.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that, Karen Lee?
Well, the situation is, sadly, Dr. Stan, let's say if we just decided that we were only going to buy American-made products. Our manufacturing base has just about been decimated in the United States. For example, let's say we're going to go buy an American car. Well, there's not one car, American car now, that is totally made in America. You may have engines made in Mexico, certain parts made in another foreign country. Try to buy an American TV. There aren't any. So products that, you know, if we would try to search out American-made products, there's some industries that have just totally disappeared. And I think this is what is so dangerous, Dr. Stan, because I maintain that we're in the early sessions of the deflationary depression. Last time around in 1929 and throughout the 30s, the only thing that turned the economy around was World War II. It was not the New Deal programs. However, you had a manufacturing base in place where you could suddenly gear up the war machine and start producing planes and so forth. There is no manufacturing base left here in the United States.
In fact, it was really very interesting. I was reading an article just tonight that, of course, the British were going to go into with us into Iraq. But because the Swiss were angry with them, and the British get their hand grenades from Switzerland, why, they would not send them any hand grenades, so these soldiers had to go into battle without adequate hand grenades. We needed certain things for certain of our missiles. The Swiss were mad because they didn't want us going in, so they would not provide those items that were needed for the construction of some of our guided missiles and guided bombs. This is what we're up against today. Why? Because the traitors in Washington, D.C. are sending our military production to countries that, of course, couldn't withhold that. So much of our military production is actually going to communist China. What's wrong with this picture?
Well, I even mentioned years ago, Dr. Stan, about 10 years ago, I did that great gold heist story with you, and one of the key points of that story was when you had these parks and mines shut down throughout the United States, for example, here in California, out in Death Valley, that area is was the largest producer of yttrium. That's rare minerals that's used in our stealth fighters and military electronics. That has all been shipped to India. So realize our very military readiness for our electronics, the rare minerals that we need and so forth, we now have to depend, not in India, that has been sent to China. So any type of a military warring situation, if they very wanted to, China would be able to stop us in our tracks. So we are at a point in time now where our natural resources that we need, any manufactured product, is produced in another foreign country. And since our manufacturing base is gone, I maintain there is absolutely nothing that is going to turn this economy of the United States around. It is only going to get more dire because of the fact that you cannot have a vital economy when you're exporting jobs and you're exporting products and you're destroying your base here in the United States.
And, of course, they are eroding our Constitution. They're getting away with it because the American people are not getting the truth. Mary, if I could suggest why, invest in helping us inform the American people about what's going on. That's the investment for yourself and for the future. And that's why I spend 5 hours a day doing what I do and why Karen Lee does what she does. Because if we can't reach the American people, why, you can forget everything.
Right. I do try to do that. But I have one other thought. We get bombarded with take out these credit cards
right. All
the time.
Right.
And I try not to charge anything because did I understand that the only way that they can print money is once we borrow? Is that right? If we borrow, then they can print money.
Well basically, that's part of it. They create credit. It's not necessarily money, but it's credit. It's all paper it's all paper entries. And of course, what happens when you borrow with your credit card, which is what you're doing, it's a paper entry. There's no real money that's being printed. We only have a certain amount of money. It's about $700 billion, or pretty close to that at present time. I remember in 1968, the money that was printed in circulation was $38 billion, and now it's about $700 billion. What does that suggest to you about the monetary supply? They create money out of nothing, but, you're better off if you don't use your credit cards, but we're not going to save America that way.
Oh, okay.
Karen Lee, what are your thoughts on what Mary said?
Well, I do agree, Dr. Stan. That's not going to save America, unfortunately. But throughout, probably about the past year and a half now, I have been telling people to really, you know, get their house in order, financially, spiritually, mentally. The best road to go financially, people should, number one, try to get out of debt. Don't put anything on a credit card. Try to be out, completely out of debt if you possibly can. And, you know, I be out of the stock market because, again, the plunge protection team is just keeping that up. That is actually not even an indicator of the economy anymore. It's a separate entity. You cannot look at the market and see the results of a robust economy because it's just smoke and mirrors right now. People really, really need to realize what is coming aside from getting financially prepared. You know, I agree with the whole stock of food, water, and spiritually prepared. I think this is the time now that God is just sort of staying his hand a little bit and giving us a little more time to get ready. And people should be really praying, reading their Bible, and seeking wisdom from the Lord, because when this comes down, it's going to be very traumatic, and people are going to need all the wisdom they can get.
Amen to that. And, of course, this is really, as you've heard me say so many times, Mary, a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, yes, even on an economic and trade battlefield.
Right.
Hey, thank you so much, Mary. It's always good to hear from you.
Thanks.
All right, let's go again now to Mike, who's calling from, of all places, Santa Cruz. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295.
Stan, forgive me for calling in twice in one program.
We'll forgive you.
Yeah.
Karen Lee, should we forgive Mike?
Oh, I think we should.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, you know, all this discussion of China and all the products made in China and related countries. China, I believe, is acting according to their own philosophies of war, as outlined by Sun Tzu in The Art of War, take over by peaceful means. You know, one of the first rules in military engagement is to discover your opponent's supply lines and cut them off or co-opt them in any way you will. China has become our supply line.
Mm-hmm.
All right, yeah, I think it's a very, very good point. But behind this all, I mean, we can look at it purely from a geopolitical point of view, which is what you're saying, but behind that are the spiritual forces that we're working within our government to bring communism to China. And David Rockefeller, who came back after they'd killed 60 million people in China and said, you know, the social experiment in China is among the most important and significant and successful in history. August of 1973, in New York Times, and you'll find that quotation in Dennis Cuddy's wonderful book entitled Secret Records Revealed. So David Rockefeller and, of course, the group he represents are part of this spiritual hierarchy. These people, of course, have given their allegiance to a different God and, of course, I believe, are part of the spiritual problem that plagues America today. So they're using communism. They have an agenda. Maybe even all the communist leaders don't understand that, but there is a spiritual hierarchy behind the political hierarchy that rules the world.
Yeah.
They talk openly about it, and any of our listeners out there who would like to read what the other side says about the spiritual hierarchy that rules the world, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Ask for the pamphlet on the spiritual hierarchy. It's put out by the Luciferians. We'll send you a copy of it. They know what's going on. They just don't want us to know.
Yeah, and what they don't want us to know, we speak of communism, but there never has been such a thing as a communist government. And those who are communists are only those who seek to delude the populace or those among the populace who are naive enough to think that such a thing as communism could exist.
Right.
Communism is nothing more than a front, a sales pitch for fascism.
All right. Good point. Anything to say, Karen Lee, in response to Mike?
Well, you know, your response was very, very good, Dr. Stan, and I'm going to give you a pitch on the air here. I've done it so many times, but I think that your book, Brotherhood of Darkness, really, is one of the best books that I have ever read on the spiritual occult powers behind what we're seeing today. today. And for those people who haven't read it, it's a very short read. What is it, 149 pages, I think. But it is one of the best books. And if people have not read that, they certainly need to, because it explains it all very simply. And if people do not understand the spiritual battle behind what's going on, the bigger picture, they never will understand what's happening.
Well, thank you for your kind words. Anything else, Mike?
Well, maybe you could spend some time devoted to the definition of that spiritual battle.
All right, fine. Thanks so much, Mike. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I think Karen Lee would agree that this is a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological battlefield. And, you know, of course, Whitaker Chambers' wonderful, wonderful quotation is in reproduced in Ann Coulter's new book, Treason. And she quotes Whitaker Chambers as saying this: communism is the world's second oldest faith. The foundation of it was whispered during the days of creation in the Garden of Eden by a serpent under the limbs of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Ye shall be as gods.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, if you stop and think what he's saying, this is what it's all about. This ruling elite, these people who want to rule the rest of our lives, they don't want us to make our own decisions. They want to control us. They believe that they are the God-given right to control the rest of it, but not God-given by the God of the Bible, but by the Prince of Darkness, by the serpent himself. And that is really what motivates the entire communist movement. And, of course, is driving us in the direction we're going, because there are many, many people in key positions in government who are part and parcel of this Luciferian movement to establish a one-world order, a new world religion. So,
and they really are going to do this through, you know, they've been through so many means, but I really believe the coup d'etat, as far as how they're going to finish off the United States, is economic. Because, you know, when you think about the history of our country, go back to World War II, how this country was able to gear up for war production, and after the war, I mean, there was not any country stronger than the United States of America. We built superior products that could not compete in foreign market could not compete back then. You take a United States product, an appliance or something made in the early 50s, and you would look at the inferior quality of a foreign-made product, and of course, you know, you couldn't even compare the two. And we had such wealth in this nation, and people were employed, and the economy was so vital. And we can see how that has just gone downhill in about 50 years' time. And economically is really how they're going to take us to our death. And with these major corporations now exporting American jobs or bringing in foreign workers, everything being done in the name of globalism, I think there isn't any more poignant symbol of what's going on than a look at the American military. The U.S. Army now, they're wearing their black berets. Their black berets are made in China. What does that say? Or do the American people even think? I think that's the whole thing, Dr. Stan. They don't think. Everyone is wrapped up in their own individual situation, and really they don't become affected until a situation affects them personally. When they lose their jobs, will they finally get a clue as to what's going on in the name of globalization? I certainly hope so. But I'm not seeing that happen yet.
Well, I think that what they really want, of course, is the social unrest and social chaos that will come when a large minority or even a majority of the people are without jobs, without income, you know, and of course the not enough money to hire adequate police. And of course you begin to see the breakdown in the social fabric of our society, which is exactly what Karl Marx was talking about. Free trade was aimed at destroying America. And it wasn't being brought in by the communists. It was brought in by our political leaders. And, of course, they operate the hallowed ground at 5080 68th Street in New York City, the hallowed ground of the Council on Foreign Relations. These elitists who believe that they know what's best for us, common folks. And, of course, many of them see absolutely nothing wrong with communism, because they really understand communism has nothing to do with redistributing the wealth of the nation. It has to do with redistributing concentrating the wealth of the middle class, impoverishing everybody, creating a ruling elite, a massive police force, with, of course, cameras on every corner, with computers keeping files on every individual, informants telling, of course, on other Americans and informing on other Americans, and then everybody else in a condition of serfdom. That is where we're headed. And, of course, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have to help us get the word out, because I think there's still an awful lot of good Americans. I think there are an awful lot of people who love this country, and that's why, of course, they're playing on our patriotism as they betray what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. And this is really a great newsletter, and I think you need to get it. I think you need to read it. And Karen Lee, do you want to put out that telephone number again?
Yes. The Investigative Reporter, again, comes out once a month. And if people are interested in subscribing or want information, they can call the office at 909-506-2781. That's 909-506-2781.
I think it's so vitally important that you are on the cutting edge of what's going on and begin making your preparations, but don't just sit around and, of course, think, well, I'm going to look after myself. Understand that we have an obligation to reach others, and the one thing that the people on the other side fear is an informed and educated American people. And that's why they play games with our minds as they do with this 16 words in the president's speech. And, of course, you know, of who put them in there and what they mean. And George Tenet was sent the speech, but he didn't read it. Do you honestly believe that, you know, the president's going to give a speech, they send it to George Tenet for his okay, and he doesn't bother to read it? I mean, is there anybody in the listening audience who really believes that story? Or that, you know, somebody else just put it in there, but see, they're terribly sorry. The trouble is that all of this is being manipulated. And, of course, it's divert attention from the really important things that are going on. And, of course, one of the most important things is they're bankrupting our nation. We're shipping our money out of this country. We have the greatest trade deficits. We're the greatest debtor nation in the world, whereas, of course, up until 20 years ago, we were the greatest lender nation. Now we're the greatest debtor nation. Furthermore, we have... they tell us there's going to be $450 billion this year, and that is the national deficit. Now, that is the had nothing to do with the trade deficit, which is $500 billion, but this is the national and the federal deficit. But they're lying once again because they're ignoring the fact they're stealing all the money out of Social Security and Medicare. There is no fund there. So really, you're talking about almost three-quarters of $1 trillion in 1 year. I mean, Ronald Reagan ran up a $1.7 trillion deficit, federal deficit, over a period of 8 years. And George Bush is going to outdo him, having almost a third of that, or almost half of that, in one single year.
Well, and you know, where's Dr. Stan?
Even from the Democrats, where's the outcry?
We have an economic situation, and... every day, you know, all you'd have to do is turn on the TV or the radio, the financial hour, and these pundits are talking about the stock market. And again, now they're going to say, I've heard recently they're saying, well, we will have recovery in 2004. I mean, they keep saying this every year. And they will quote the stocks or the bond market, even while all these markets are vital. I maintain it does not matter at this point in time what the stock market does. It does not matter how the bond market performs. All these economic indices that do not mean a thing as long as you continue to replace American workers and export American jobs at the rate that we are doing. I don't care if we're looking at a 10,000, even a 12,000 point Dow Jones. It doesn't matter. And this is the big thing. People have to realize what we are seeing every day is smoke and mirrors. We are not getting any truth from the government as far as any of these figures go. But again, bottom line, it doesn't matter. What you would have to do at this point in time would actually be able to turn around NAFTA and GATT or stop these free trade agreements with Singapore and Chile right in their tracks. But unfortunately, my husband was just reading a quote to me from the paper before we came on the air. Orrin Hatch and some of these other congressmen are still saying how wonderful these new free trade programs with Singapore and Chile are going to be and how many jobs they're going to produce. It's ludicrous. Exactly. It's ludicrous. There are no jobs.
And I think it's really so important to understand that the value of the American dollar in comparison with the euro has fallen 34% in the last 2 years. And, of course, everybody keeps saying, well, when is it going to bounce back again? And I don't think it's going to bounce back again. And if you are in fixed assets, if you are in insurance policies and annuities and bonds or anything, a pension fund, they can give you, you know, $1,000 a month. But, of course, it may not buy three loaves of bread. And you have to understand that once they destroy the value of your currency, you're in real trouble, and they're in the process of intentionally undermining the fabric of our nation. Right now we've got Theodora calling. Hi, Theodora. I haven't heard from you in some time.
Well, you know, I do listen, and I don't, I'm not somebody who needs to hear my own voice. So I wait to get the call that I have something to add to the conversation.
Okay.
And it's a good one, so thank you both. I want to add in the, you were talking about the congressmen who were, you know, so many of them are just still have their head in the sands about NAFTA and GATT and all the other treaties that are going on that are allowing our corporations to move overseas and replace American workers. And I wanted to draw your attention to and your listeners' attention to the candidacy for the president in the Democratic Party, Kucinich, who, among other things, really has a lot to recommend him as a populist activist rather than a Democrat or a Republican or, you know, these are, you know, we have to look beyond the terms if we really want to choose people who are going to represent us. But Kucinich is very clear that one of the first things he would do were he to become president is rescind NAFTA and GATT.
Right.
And we need to find our allies wherever they pop up, and this is such an important issue. So I just want to encourage people out there to think outside the box and check out all the people who put their name up. And Kucinich is one of those people who represents the middle class and the workers. He is not a corporate Democrat.
Well, can you get his telephone number? Maybe we get him on.
Well, it's Kucinach, probably .com or .org. It rhymes with spinach, Kucinich.
All right, fine.
We know spinach is good for us, so check out Kucinich.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, too.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that, of course, is Theodora calling in. And if you have any questions or comments, we're just about out of time. But it is vitally important that our listeners understand that, of course, we're not being told the truth about what's happening economically. The jobs are leaving America forever. There is a planned program to destroy us economically, and I believe, of course, to transfer the world leadership eventually towards the European Union. And, of course, the European Union is a direct product of America. We created this. We've been subsidizing it by keeping our troops over there so they would have all this money that they could utilize to bribe the people with all their wonderful welfare benefits paid for by the good old American tax dollars, good old American taxpayers. So we have actually created this European Union, which, of course, was the best competitor money can buy. Now, if you look at this from a completely logical point of view, it doesn't make any sense. If you look at it from the spiritual point of view and you understand that our leaders have no loyalty to America, at least the spiritual hierarchy doesn't, and they have always intended to transfer the leadership back to Europe, then it begins to make sense. We are building up this powerful bloc that will be the biggest trading bloc in the world as they take in some 9 new nations in Eastern Europe, and of course, probably before long, they will incorporate Russia, because the plan has always been a united Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals. This is what the plan is, but they're not telling the American people. And then we begin to see them tightening down on their welfare benefits, and everybody over there is screaming. But they're, of course, going to get their economic house in order, and we're going to destroy ours. And at that point, of course, the America that we've known will simply be part of the ash bin of history. And that is exactly what Lucifer has always wanted. He's hated America because we were a Christian nation. Too bad we lost it. Karen Lee, we're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I just briefly want to thank you again for having me on the air, Dr. Stan, because I think this is a very important story, and people need to realize this job situation, and hopefully we'll take some action or try to. But again, I maintain it's time for everyone to get their house in order. And again, I, as a Christian, I would say there isn't anything more important that a person can do right now to have a relationship with the Lord and just continue to pray and read their Bible and get as close to the Lord as they possibly can during these times.
Amen to that. Well, God bless you, Karen Lee, and thank you so much for being with us here at Radio Liberty. We'll look forward to having you on in the very, very near future.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night. And first, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest has been Karen Lee Bixman, the investigative reporter, and I hope you will heed what she's talking about. Her latest article, The Eye of the Hurricane. And, of course, you know, the winds are roaring all around, but you're in the eye of the hurricane. Why, it doesn't seem that anything bad can happen. Unfortunately, we are in a very, very difficult time. The stock market is being kept up artificially because with the stock market, they can influence how we feel. And you find when the stock market is down, everybody's depressed. When the market is up, everybody feels good. And, of course, it's all smoke and mirrors, as Karen Lee said so very well. It's all symbolism over substance. And because by manipulating that stock market, by having the plunge protection team go in, why, they can make the American people feel good. So we're not really keeping a close eye on what's happening as they continue exporting our jobs, exporting our future, exporting our freedom. And, of course, as they impose through DARPA and the other government agency, a total surveillance society. Well, we're just about out of time. So this is Dr. Stan saying, pray for America. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. Give serious thought to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters so we can really expand our outreach across America. And lastly, please, of course, pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.